Thanks for downloading this episode of Cork Talk with me, Tim Atkin. A weekly conversation with some of the most famous people in the world of wine.
This podcast is brought to you in partnership with Nomacork by Vinventions. Driven by a commitment to innovation, the new plant-based Nomacork Green Line offers significant improvements in wine closure performance. Thanks to a rigorous oxygen ingress rate, you can decide which cork is best for your wine, whether it's for young and fresh wines or for those with aging potential.
Universally known as Bubbles, Peter Ferreira is a sparkling wine legend. Chairman of the Cap Classique Producers Association and cellar master at Graham Beck, he knows more about fizz than anyone else in South Africa. Listen to his chat about what he learnt from the French in Champagne, how Springbok rugby legend Jan Bolan Coetzee influenced his life, the mysteries of autolysis, and Graham Beck's exciting new project in the UK. Hello, Peter, how are you?
Hey, Tim, so nice to hear your voice.
Thank you. And likewise, it's so nice to hear from you. Listen, man, where are you?
Well, I'm in Franschhoek at our home. And we obviously this week celebrated a bit of spring. But yeah, today was a miserable winter's day, you know. But it's all good.
I'm not going to say I feel terrible for you because, you know, you're going into summer now and we're just starting the long slide into autumn. Summer's over. That's it.
Yeah, it's amazing how quickly it changes, you know. All of a sudden, you know, the sun rises earlier and we have a longer afternoon. So it's really amazing. And it reminds me and reflects a little bit on what the vintage gave us in 2021. Obviously, you know, as spring arises now, we have to think about 2022 harvest already.
Yeah.
But yeah, 21 is a beautiful unsung hero, I think. It's a vintage to look out for.
Everybody sounds very excited because it was quite cool, wasn't it? Which is obviously going to be great for sparkling wines in particular.
It was extremely cool. We had the best sort of start to early summer, obviously in the Robertson region where our winery is. And it's just been good all over, you know, and our grapes were off and then it just remained cool. And, you know, I think there's going to be some stunning wines out of the 21.
We're going to see those in sort of 4 or 5 years' time, though, aren't we? Probably at the top end. Yeah.
Well, hopefully we can keep the bank managers happy, you know, that way. But it definitely, look out for the 21 vintage. It's extremely exciting.
Yeah, we all face that challenge. Listen, I mean, I've called you Peter. I mean, everybody calls you Bubbles, basically, because you are Mr. Bubbles. You're the king of sparkling wines in South Africa. But I want to just talk a little bit about your background, really, because it's quite interesting that you were born not in the Western Cape, but in Durban, which is not exactly wine country. And you describe yourself as a bit of a surfer dude growing up. Just wondered if your family had any links with wine. Did you drink it as a kid?
Well, I was very fortunate in the way that my late father was in wine distribution. And, you know, so there was always wine at home and things like that. I didn't really knew you sort of had a private little stash away or a cellar. So wine was really quite obvious for us. And we were very fortunate, even at a very young age, to be exposed to wine. And, you know, obviously the sweeter ones were always more delicious. But, you know, so your palate developed over time. So, yeah, very fortunate, although no direct links to any winemaking or sort of any wine farms.
Can you remember the first wine you drank?
Oh, it's quite vivid in my mind. I don't know if you remember Bellingham Johannesburger. Podlashuk, it's a beautiful story. Podlashuk, who was the winemaker owner then of Bellingham, the historic wine farm in Franschhoek, looked up against the Drakenstein Mountains and he saw this beautiful little peak and he got the bottle shaped. And that was the label. It was a bottle that looked like that. So that's how I clearly remember it, you know. Because everybody who had an empty bottle had a candle in it because it looked so charming.
You know? A bit like Matthias Rosé in England in the 1970s.
Very similar to that. It's quite the same story, yes. Yeah.
Listen, you studied microbiology, plant sciences, rather than enology, didn't you, at the University of Pretoria? Did you have any idea at that point that you wanted to become a winemaker? Because I read somewhere you were thinking about becoming a dentist, another winemaker who nearly became a dentist.
Well, luckily, I didn't fall into that trap. You know, luckily, my final year results at school wasn't good enough. Yeah, so, you know. No time for dentists, but it was sort of a thought. And then I happily went to study microbiology and soil science and various others, and had no inkling that it will get me one day into the wine business. So, it was just a fortuitous moment.
Yeah, but you've got the scientific background. That's the point.
Absolutely. You know, microbiology, you learn all about the bugs and the things and yeasts and things like that. And we studied that all, you know, during the time of study. So, the foundation's there today for sure.
I mean, then the great Jan Boland Coetzee, that many people will know, legendary Springbok and Stellenbosch winemaker, obviously was at Canonkop for a while, a long time. Played an important part in your life, as he did in many people's lives, really. What happened? How did Jan intervene? Not on a rugby field, I'm glad to say.
Yeah,
I don't think I'd like Jan to intervene with me on a rugby field.
As I alluded, my dad was in the distribution business, and one of the very early wine farms that they took into the Durban area, into it was then known as Natal, which is KwaZulu-Natal today, one of them was Canonkop. So there was a direct relationship, and obviously whenever there was rugby, because my father was a rugby mad, you know. It's a little bit like Roger Jones in the UK, you know, the similar feeling, eat, sleep and drink rugby. And obviously whenever Jan was in town for a rugby match, you know, where he came to our home, and, you know, so that was sort of a connection. And lo and behold, my father's partner in the business was the first shareholder with Achim von Arnhem in Franschhoek. And after their first little board meeting, Ian Hoyer came back and told my dad, listen, your son must go and work for Achim. And it was weird, but I'll try and keep it short, but it's a beautiful story. He put me on the plane and I came down. I met up with a crazy guy called Achim, spent a weekend with him, and I was so confused because, you know, it was like I was indoctrinated. Now I'm really confused. And I stopped at Jan. Jan then was already at Frisenhof. On my way to the airport, I stopped and spoke to Jan. And Jan just listened. He didn't say much. And I said, he says, at your age, the only and best way you're going to do is to learn it on the job. There's enough friends in the wine business, and I will make sure you become a success. On the Monday, when I was back in Durban, I phoned Achim and said, I'm coming down. And that is how I landed. It's like landing into a wine tank. So, you know, you had to swim very, very well to stay with your head above water.
I mean, he's quite a character, isn't he? I remember the first time I went to see him, he very proudly told me that he'd just been given the award for the second time running for South Africa's worst dressed man. He was very proud. And he had those enormous, great big sort of, what were they, kind of display cases with elephant droppings in them. He got these special elephant droppings he'd collected from all over Africa. He's a crazy guy.
He was incredible. You know, we had that elephant droppings in a glass cage.
Yeah.
You know, he says, no, it has to be here because Franschhoek was known as Olifant's, you know, the elephant's corner, and you know, all crazy, crazy things. But yeah, indeed a madman, but I would really never turn back to what I've learned from him. He was a really stalwart. He was also a mentor in my life. He taught me everything bubbles, which, you know, where it is today.
I mean, you stayed there 7 years, didn't you?
I stayed 7 years. So my first vintage in the wine business was 1984, and spent incredible 7 years with Achim. And really, you know, he taught me one thing about bubbles: you eat, sleep, and drink it. And, you know, he was also burning candles on both sides because he was involved. He was the winemaker at Boschendal then. But yeah, I think with me under his wing, he felt extremely calm, and we had amazing 7 years together.
And when did you decide you wanted to be Mr. Bubbles? You wanted to focus on sparkling wine and nothing else?
That's a good question. I really think, you know, it sounds like I don't know enough, you know, but I didn't know anything else. Achim was the first specialist producer of Cap Classique in South Africa. It was the first specialist seller just to produce Cap Classique. So, you know, it was just fortuitous. I loved the mystique and the magic of a bubble, and yeah, and that's how I, you know, never wanted to change, really.
Yeah, I love the idea of the mystique and the magic of a bubble. While we're on the subject of bubbles, I was going to ask you this later, but I'll ask you now. Does the size of the bubble tell you anything about the quality of the wine? I know it's something that's debated sometimes in the business.
How much time have we got?
But no, it's give it the short answer.
You know, yeah, the string is short today. I really do believe it does not really happen only when you go into the secondary fermentation. A lot of people say, well, it's, you know, it's only about time on the lees versus time on the cork that will have an influence in the bubble. But I truly believe the best contribution any bubbly producer can make in terms of making the bubble relatively more smaller is how you handle the fruit from picking. So when that grape leaves the vine till it's in juice form. All winemakers have a similar approach when they have juice in the cellar. And I truly believe, you know, to quantify that step is most probably about 60 to 65%.
Is fruit quality. Okay, yeah.
Besides the fruit quality, it's also about the pressing programs. Mm. You know, I know of many, many people all around the world who presses on a champagne program. They will press and finish a cycle in an hour and a half. I still cannot get under 3 hours for one cycle. So it's all about the intrinsics, how you separate the juice fractions, you know, the cuvee fraction from the ties, and many, many things. But all those things definitely gives you an opportunity to get to consistency and continuity, and with that comes for smaller bubbles.
Definitely. So smaller bubbles are better than big bubbles.
Yeah, definitely. You know, if you have a big bubble, you know, you intend to rise off your seat, you know, if you're not standing, you know, the bubbles is a nuisance, sort of dissipates, and it really, like, it becomes an aggressive thing, where a much smaller, tiny bubble, it's more like a feather on the tongue, you know, it's if you just take a feather, that small little pinprick bubbles is definitely, it's all about how you, you know, how you put attention to detail.
I like that. I mean, you joined Graham Beck, where you are now, and I don't want to remind you of this, but it's over 30 years. You joined in 1990. And Graham Beck was another pretty forceful character. I met him a few times. How did you get the job? Is it true that you didn't actually have an interview? I mean, did he just decide he liked you?
No, you know what? This is also another crazy story. And Jan Boerland could see us all in, you know.
He's there again.
Yeah, it's him again. Can you believe it? Jan met Graham Beck in Robertson after Graham Beck knew a guy called Baron von Essen who had interest in a wine farm just outside Durbanville. And they, on international travels, they bumped into each other. And Jan said, well, Graham said, I've got this farm in Robertson. I want to plant some grapes and grow, you know, do some bubbles. He says, well, there's only one guy you have to meet, it's Jan Boerland. And Jan Boerland, when he moved to Friesenhof, he was really the consultant. A lot of people approached him, you know, his expertise and his sort of method of thinking and things like that. So when Graham got back to South Africa, he phoned Jan and says, Jan, I want to see you. So Jan Boerland had a meeting with Graham in Robertson. And that very same afternoon, Jan came back via Franschhoek when I was with Achim and said, I've met this incredible man. You know what? He wants to do a bit of sparkling wine. Can you come and help consult me and, you know, get the right people in mind, which I'm sure Achim wouldn't mind. So the very first meeting we had in April 1990, Jan had to get an architect, engineers, and obviously Jan invited me to be part of it. Grainbeck walked in, he looked around, he says, who's the architect? Architect put his hand up, he says, you've got all the right guys around the table, build me a cellar. And that was it. Bizarre. But incredibly visionary. We still, right today, 30 years later, still trying to why he had bubbly in his mind. And yeah. The only one reason that I do believe Robertson has taught Graham Beck, he brought his thoroughbred horses to Robertson because there was much more calcium in the feed due to the natural limestone deposits.
It was good for bones.
So it was good. The horses became stronger and all of a sudden he started to win races. And obviously he became the most successful thoroughbred breeder in South Africa.
Interesting. So, and how did you get the job? Did he just give you the job in this room at the same time?
He left and didn't say a word. And then I had a phone call from his son, Anthony, and says, I believe I have to show you the farm. Crazy. Yeah. But yeah, what an incredible journey. Oh, man, it's just we've come a full circle. We've actually, you know, the vision Graham Beck had is really up and strong and running in Robertson.
I mean, you've told us a little bit about Robertson, particularly about the limestone in the soil, which is quite unusual in the Cape, isn't it? Tell us a bit more about the climate and the terroir of this place and why it's so special for sparkling wines.
I gladly talk about it now because with global warming and climate change on everyone's lips, wherever one travels, that is what people are talking about. Yeah. It's really, I think all of a sudden, you know, everybody seems to be a little bit warmer. And obviously Robertson in many, many years ago, and it was a major challenge in the early years when I joined in the 90s, to, you know, the effect of sunshine. But it's one of our secret weapons in Robertson is sunshine. We have abundance of sunshine, and it really makes for us to be able to deliver consistency and continuity through every single vintage. So sunshine is one of the important factors. But, you know, over the years, we've readdressed the row directions that we can get our grapes to grow in shade. So we don't have the most beautiful upright canopies in summer, but they sprawl a little bit, but that is how we can, you know, ripen our fruit in the shade. Then we did touch on the limestone deposits. Robertson region is the area with the highest occurrence of natural limestone, and it's obvious because we can see so many more and more Cap Classique producers sourcing fruit from Robertson. And then last but not least is the importance of the diurnal shift, which is the day and night temperature change. We could comfortably have a 36-degree day, but at night we will lose at least 20 degrees. So it will be virtually 15 degrees at night.
Yeah.
And as the plant has worked extremely hard at daytime through transpiration, at night it can rest, so we call it respiration, and sort of re-energizes the plant. At the same time, with the limestone, obviously we secure natural high acidities, and it's made Robertson one of the leading growing areas for Cap Classique.
Probably the leading area, I'd say, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I'm happy you say that because, you know, when I say it, oh, there goes Ferreira again. But it's proven. I can really tell you all the more important Cap Classique brands in South Africa ask one of their supply chains, and it will be Robertson. So we're happy to share. It's really important.
And this week, in fact, or certainly this year, you're celebrating the 50th anniversary of the first Cap Classique, haven't you, in 1971. Just tell us a little bit about the association, the Cap Classique Producers Association, because you're the chairman. I just wondered how many members you have, and is the category growing in South Africa?
Yeah, it's a really exciting time for Cap Classique. Yeah, the first Kaapse Funkel from Simonsig was produced in 71 by Frans Malan. And he was fairly shy in those days to show the wines around. So only late in the late 70s, he introduced Kapsfunkel. It was then known as the most expensive wine in South Africa, at a whole 3 rand. You know, it's quite crazy and bizarre.
Fortune.
Anyway, and then in the mid-80s, a few more members came up. So at the time of 1992, when the association was formed, there was 14 like-minded wineries that got together. We were still allowed to have a reference to Méthode Champenoise, but we knew the writing was on the board. In 1995, it became an international ruling that only wines from Champagne can be referred to as Méthode Champenoise. Yeah. So we got together. We did a long weekend. We invited Michael Fridjon and a few other people for a long weekend, and we had lots of bubbles. So we got very clever. And, you know, as things go, we thought of the Cape, so it became Cap because we wanted to sound slightly French, and then Classique, the traditional classic method. So that's where Cap Classique was born.
Yeah. Today, it's a good name, I think, do you?
Yeah, Cap refers to the Cape, Classique to the classic method, which is all about bottle fermentation. So we didn't have to rediscover the wheel. We just wanted to be uniquely South African. So that's how it all came.
And how many members do you have now?
Today we have 104 members. If you study the amount of producers involved in the production in South Africa, there's about 220 producers. We have 104 producers, but we speak for well over 90% of the total production of the Classique.
Yeah. I mean, you've been making sparkling wine, I hate to remind you this, for 37 years in South Africa. Just how has it changed? What's changed about South African sparkling wine in that time, about Cap Classique?
I think the attention to detail and the seriousness. You know, people that did not do it on a yearly basis, and, you know, you do one, then you skip one or two vintages. Those are definitely, they don't last, because the consumer likes specific sort of house styles. So anybody who has developed a house style and that has managed to maintain the consistency and continuity has definitely seen the growth in it. So, you know, in the early days, maybe we only knew that you could blend Chardonnay and Pinot Noir, for instance, together. So a lot of the original Cap Classiques were blends, and then the sort of various styles of Cap Classique have emerged over time. We now have a fully fledged category of Blanc de Blanc. We have rosés, we have Blanc de Noirs, we even have prestige cuvées now. So the whole category has sort of into sort of an understanding, you know, that we can produce beautiful and various styles. And within that, there's obviously various sugar levels, but it's the international regulation of sugar levels. So, you know, we adhere to that. And then obviously there's also non-vintage versus vintage, but that depends on the brand itself, how they take that message.
Most of the best ones, including the ones that you make, obviously, are made from the classic French grape varieties that you find in Champagne, so Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, Pinot Meunier. But there are lots of other things used, aren't there? Other grapes used to make sparkling wine. Tell us what they are.
Yeah, Tim, first of all, I think we do understand, and we really sort of celebrate the idea of a rainbow nation in South Africa. We don't have to go into politics, but, you know, I think that diversity of our terroirs and the diversity of our sort of holistic approach and the various regions have definitely said we would rather be inclusive on a level one for Cap Classique, and we will allow, you know, any varietal to be used. You know, if Cap Classique was started by Chenin Blanc, why exclude it now, you know? And there's other varietals as Pinotage and, Shiraz, Cabernet Franc, I know of Sauvignon Blancs, and there is even a touch of Viognier here and there, definitely is coming through, you know, and there's a small little category, maybe less than 1% of pet nuts and things like that, where you're starting to see various, you know, Grenache Blancs and things like that emerging.
It's pretty vibrant category, isn't it?
We're definitely vibrant. It is still the only category in South Africa that grows in double digits. Just for your interest, I missed it to tell you just now, but 80% of all Cap Classique remains in the local market. 20% goes into the international markets.
Yeah.
But the UK is by far the most important market for Cap Classique in South Africa.
We're drinking lots of it. Good to hear.
You are doing extremely well. You know, there's around 684,000 bottles. That equates to 57,000 cases.
Goes to the UK.
That comes to the UK. It's amazing. Yeah. And, you know, during our prohibition and things like that, anybody that was ready to enter the export market, they managed to get wines to the UK. The UK has been really supportive. They've had their initiatives like Save South African Wine and Drink More South African Wine. Well done to everyone in the UK for supporting South Africa so dearly.
Good to hear. But do you think the top Cap Classiques get the recognition they deserve, especially outside South Africa? You're talking about the UK, but are they recognised as being, you know, world class at the top end? Or do people still think French is best?
I think French will remain aspirational for any bottle fermented sparkling wine producer. It still seems to be the international benchmark. My divine inspiration comes from a trip to Champagne. I have no secrets about that. It's definitely, you come back enriched and you feel invigorated and things like that. So I think French will always be the benchmark. But as I said, Cap Classique is uniquely South African. It's got its own thumbprint. It tastes more like sunshine. It is not an imitation. We are uniquely the better alternative if you don't want to do champagne.
Yeah. I mean, talking of France, and you've mentioned the fact that you go there regularly. You've worked there twice in your life, haven't you? I think in the 80s, 87, you were at Mumm. And then Moët, the big, big, big producer in 89. I just wonder, what did you learn from the French, particularly from working in such big companies?
I could be blasé. I think they learned something from me, you know. No. Then obviously I was still a rookie. I've got dear friends, and we often speak a lot over Zoom and things like that now during lockdown, and we can't travel. We share so many ideas, but what they've taught me is definitely attention to detail and, you know, make wine like there is no tomorrow, really, you know, otherwise you miss an opportunity. Most probably the most intriguing, again, is the sort of reception of the grapes. I've mentioned that a little bit earlier. But how you handle the fruit from picking till it's in juice form. Because once it's in juice form, we all have sort of more of an international, like-minded sort of work ethic.
You do the same things. Really.
We pretty much do the same things, you know. Do cool ferments, going to barrel, not going to barrel, the use of reserve. Those things become a little bit more universal. But, yeah, I think that is what I learned, is how to handle fruit. The importance thereof.
I mean, you've also made wine in the States, haven't you, with Jackson Family Wines? And now I believe in England, you're involved with a project in England called Graham Beck in Great Britain, GB in GB. This is at Hambledon, isn't it? Tell us a little bit about that. What, have you released any wines yet?
It's really exciting. You know, I remain an aspirational winemaker, and I one day told Graham Beck, I think we need to make wine in Champagne. He says, well, go and find something. So obviously he sent me, but I came back with an idea of having, you know, owning 1 hectare. My God, I think we will still be only paying for the third vine rather than the vineyard. It was just simply too expensive. He says, well, I guess there's other places in the world that can accommodate you. So I started off in the US. It's been an amazing five-year project, which I started at Stone Street. Mm-hmm. And really exciting things to come out there. The first wines are just being made ready for their market. And then with the inkling of not being in Champagne, obviously the UK is the next buzz for Fizz per se. I respect what's been done and what still can happen in the UK or in Great Britain. And yeah, quite apt. Follow the hashtag, you know, GB and GB. It's going to be an exciting one.
We so when's it going to come out?
Well, we started in 2016. So, you know, okay. it's a little bit of a late, slow start because we wanted to buy virgin land and, you know, be in control of our own vineyards and things like that. And then we realized, wow, you know, the system there to get something passed and to get a footprint to build a winery just simply wasn't going to work. But it gave us lots of opportunity to look at all the areas. You know, now we're starting in Kent and we're working through East and West Sussex and ended up in Hampshire. Got a very good understanding of the lay of the land and managed to hook up with Ian Collette of Hambledon, who gave us the opportunity to rent cellar space and use their winery. And I do it a little bit like a negotiant. So I have my five different spots, which we have sort of autonomy on the vineyard blocks. We started in 2018, and hopefully we can be there for the harvest this year, which is slightly more challenging again. But we haven't released any yet. Obviously, it will be under the Grainbec umbrella, and it's really exciting. I truly believe we want to have at least 3 to 4 years lease contact. Again, we don't want to be a follower. We want to set an example, the importance of time on the lease, and we will definitely most probably only release then towards the end of next year, our first release.
I think it's interesting. I mean, time on the lease that you're talking about quite a bit. I think for people listening who don't know much about sparkling wine production, this time on the lees, or tolysis, as it's sometimes called in the business, that happens in bottle after the second fermentation. Why is that so important for sparkling wine, particularly for very high end stuff? Why does more time give you more complexity?
I think it still remains a fine line, and there's still a lot of debate. You know, whether equal time on the lees and equal time on the cork is the ideal situation.
Explain the difference.
But the difference is, first of all, when you go into a secondary fermentation, there is a lease deposit that forms with it, which is the yeast that has reacted to the sugar and converted that into alcohol and CO2, so the natural pressure. But then you have the sedimentation, and there's definitely minimum requirements wherever you go. Most countries have their own legislation on time on the lees. In South Africa,
it tends to be a year, doesn't it? At least a year.
In South Africa, it was up to this year. It's been only 9 months, and we have changed the wine laws. So Kaptla Signa has to be 12 months on the lease.
Since from this vintage?
Yes, from the 2021 vintage onwards. And then if you look at Cava, you look at Franciacorta, they have anything from 18 to 36 months. Champagne is 15 months minimum. Vintages is normally 3 years plus. So anyway, having this yeast deposit in the bottle, you talked about the autolysis. This is where the yeast sort of goes into a relaxed mode, and a lot of the amino acids that was taken and consumed by the yeast during fermentation now imparts the characteristics of the yeast flavors into the wine. So the longer we can leave it on the lees, the more texture you will get. So I always say the biggest difference between a shorter time on the lees, you're showing much more primary fresh fruit aromatics, but the longer you can leave it on the yeast, the more texture and the more complexity you can show, that little bit of umami aromatics. And then obviously that sort of life of the final product really only starts developing when the final cork is on. I just last week.
That's after disgorgement, is it?
I just last week showed a wine that we produced in 1991 at Grainbeck, a maiden vintage that is still lying on the lees and it's not dead. It's beautiful. It's fresh. Yes, it has developed all that sort of tertiary aromatics, but it was still fresh.
And time on cork, you mean after disgorgement, do you?
So time on cork definitely has an influence. We've definitely learned and we're trying to teach our consumer that when we speak that this wine has 5 to 6 years, life left on declaring the date of disgorging, it's not the vintage it was made from. It's actually from the date of disgorging.
So when at the end of autolysis and the beginning of bottle aging without
yes.
any contact.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, I think that's fascinating. I always think of the autolysis characters as being the ones that we describe as wine writers with a Y. You know, toasty, bready, nutty, all of those things tend to me to seem to be autolysis related characters. But maybe they're time on cork related characters as well, are they?
Definitely. The French has a saying that you get the taste of the French and the taste of the English. This is most probably, going back 30, 40 years ago, definitely there was always a trend that the French like to drink champagne quite young and fresh, where the English really, you can just go back to Churchill. And they loved more the sort of matured, softer aromatics, and that was wines that had a long time on the cork. Paul Roger, for instance, there's a great story about that, because they always went to find the oldest bottle corked wine for Sir Winston Churchill. Amazing.
Oh, dear. There's nothing I've got to ask you. Your philosophy on life. You told fellow wine writer Marlu Lambert, who I like very much, you said, when my feet hit the ground in the morning, I'm already celebrating. Is that as close as we get to the Bubbles philosophy of life, do you think?
Yeah. I think I'm also getting to an age where, I celebrate when I can stand up,
I know the feeling.
Well, it's a lovely feeling, but anyway, I know, Bubbles really have consumed my life, but it's become part of the way we live. And it is all about celebration. You cannot but have a smile on your face when you pop a cork. It's just one of those things. And you know what I've learned? It's always 12 o'clock somewhere or 5 o'clock somewhere. You don't have to wait for your own time zone. It's somewhere. So it's time to celebrate, but it's really important, that you get a balance in life because work hard. I think it's a bit of a Grainbeck cliche, but, if you work hard, you can play hard, but you have to find the balance. And obviously spend some time with the family.
Well, your family is amazing. Your wife, Anne, I think you proposed to her with a bottle of Dom Perignon in Champagne, didn't you?
Oh, amazing story that, that is. And I had to, we didn't have glasses because it was too fragile.
You drank it from the bottle?
No, we eventually did. But we went down to the sort of local supermarket just off the Reims train station and got these worst disastrous. Why, it was tasting eventually better out of the bottle than in the glass.
It's good you obviously said yes, because you took that bottle all the way from South Africa, didn't you, to propose to her.
Never forget, that was a 78 Dom Perignon, which also was quite a spectacular year. But it's really about it. And we've had a long, beautiful journey together in the wine business.
Yeah, no, she's an amazing person. Anyway, listen, Peter, Bubbles, it's been fascinating sharing your knowledge, just hearing from you. I mean, we've only scratched the surface of sparkling winemaking. I mean, your knowledge is just incredible. I always learn an enormous amount tasting with you. It's been great fun. See you soon, I hope. I mean, maybe in England with the GB in GB.
Absolutely. I cannot wait. Unfortunately, South Africa is still on the red list to the UK. Yeah. So I'm trying all sorts of things. At least I can quarantine in Champagne for 11 nights, and then take the train into the UK. But I'll definitely keep in touch. Thank you for the opportunity. It's really great to speak.
It'd be great to see you. I'll see you in the Cape probably.
We'd love to. I mean, you had the T-shirt, but you couldn't use it, for last year. So
we're waiting.
We're waiting to receive you. Thank you so much.
All right, Peter. Thank you, man.
Thank you. Bye, Tim.
Bye.
Talking to Peter always puts a smile on my face. Next week on Cork Talk, my guest is the author and food scientist Harold McGee, who'll be telling me all about Nosedive, his fascinating new book about the world of smells. See you then. Thanks for listening to Cork Talk. If you want to read more reports, articles and tasting notes by me, go to my website, timatkin.com. You can also follow me on Twitter, @timatkin, and on Instagram, @timatkinmw. See you next week.